From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with action hero Chuck Norris. The karate expert turned movie star is fighting his way through a new film, Braddock Missing in Action Part 3. Also today, I talk with magician Penn Jillette. Along with his silent partner Teller, Jillette has mixed together magic and bad taste and brought the combination to Broadway. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles Hank Ballard and the Midnighters. In the 1950s, their songs about a girl named Annie were hits, even though they were too risque to get played on the radio. And book critic John Leonard reviews Woodcutters, Thomas Bernhard's novel about life in the Viennese art scene. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Chuck Norris broke into movies in a fight to the death against Kung Fu master Bruce Lee in Return of the Dragon. Norris had learned karate in Korea while in the Air Force. Back in California, he became the world middleweight karate champion, a title he held for 6 years. He also set up karate academies where he taught several Hollywood celebrities. One of his pupils, Steve McQueen, encouraged him to pursue a career in acting. He went on to make 12 Kung Fu films and became a martial arts cult hero. Then he diversified to become an all-around tough guy action hero. In the last 3 years, he has appeared in Code of Silence, Invasion USA, Delta Force, and Missing in Action Parts 1, 2, and now Braddock Missing in Action Part 3, which opened last week. Chuck Norris has also written an autobiography. It's titled The Secret of Inner Strength. I spoke with him from the NPR studio in New York. I asked him to describe the kind of karate he learned while stationed in Korea.
Well, it's at that time it was called Tang Soo Do. Today it's more prominently known as Taekwondo, which is an emphasis on kicking.
Okay. Now, you taught karate in America, won many karate championships. Bruce Lee got you your first film roles. Did you already want to break into acting when you met Bruce Lee?
No, not at all. When I did the film with Bruce, I had no desire to be an actor. I was still in the karate business and still competing, and I did Return of the Dragon strictly as a kick.
No pun intended.
No pun intended,
right.
Okay.
Well, that was in 1972. Would you describe the fight scene that you were in Return of the Dragon?
Well, when, of course, the fight scene is to the death in the Colosseum in Rome, about basically like two gladiators pitting their skills against each other. And it was very exciting, you know, to be in the Colosseum in Rome and just look out into the arena there and think that a few hundred years ago they were doing it for real. So it was quite exciting, actually.
Now, you both choreographed the scene together, right? Yourself, yeah. And Bruce Lee?
Yeah, we'd worked out together for about 3 years prior to this. And so when we decided to do the film, the fight itself, he said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I'll do this, this, and this. So we just kind of choreographed it right there on the set.
Now, you did Korean karate, Taekwondo, and he was a Chinese form of karate,
right.
Kung Fu. Were there any differences in style that you had to reconcile before getting the choreography together?
No, not at all, because we'd both studied many other styles as well. And I'd studied the Chinese and, you know, with Bruce and the Japanese style. So I was really a conglomeration of several styles, and so was Bruce Lee. Bruce didn't stick strictly to the Chinese styles. He'd studied many different styles. So there was a real good chance, you know, ability of us working together.
Now, in the scene, I imagine that you didn't really hit each other hard. I mean, what are the rules there when you're choreographing a fight scene for the movie? How did you do it in 1972?
Well, of course, we didn't go to hurt each other. There's light contact, but just as we'd make contact, we'd, you know, pull the blow right at the point of contact rather than following through with it, you know, so we could finish the fight.
Is that something you're used to from sparring?
Yeah, you learn to control your kicks, and especially from my movies, you know, I have to learn to do that in my films to keep from hurting the stuntmen.
Did you enjoy Kung Fu movies at the time? Did you see a lot of them?
In the beginning I did, but they became redundant. They were all the same. You know, when you have a movie that just has fight from beginning to end and there's no story or no emotion involved, it becomes redundant and it gets boring after a few minutes of watching kick, 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 punch, punch. And so it's important, I think, that's why they died out. That's why there's no longer those kind of films in the American market. is the fact that after a while you get bored of them. That's why I didn't want to do those kind of films.
But early on, didn't you want to convince Hollywood that you would be a good star for kung fu type American vehicles?
In the beginning, of course, when I was trying to break through into the film business, when Bruce Lee died, the karate market or the kung fu market in movies died with him. All producers thought, well, since Bruce died, there was no one else that could fulfill that bill. And so when I finally broke in 77, I was known as the kung fu star, in Hollywood or in the media. But I knew that if I was stuck strictly as a kung fu star, that my career would be very limited and I'd never, wouldn't be able to grow. So I started working more into the action orientation of my films with, martial arts or karate integrated into the action. And that way I wouldn't be limited to being strictly a kung fu star, and that's what's worked for me.
What were some of the things that you had to learn in order to broaden into more general action films?
Learning how to act was the main thing. Remember, I jumped into the films with absolutely no experience as an actor, had a very little acting classes and so forth, so I had to kind of learn on the job, and it wasn't easy to do that.
Wasn't there a certain amount of acting you have to do to be successful in karate?
No, not acting like you do on the screen, because it's a total different thing. You have to have that drive and determination like an actor does, and you have to, you're performing, but it's on a physical level. But in films, when you're doing scenes over and over again, see, remember when you're fighting, it's spontaneous. But when you do a film, everything is prearranged. You have marks you have to hit. You have to have to do the scenes over and over again. And so it's much more difficult that way.
Well, Steve McQueen, who was a friend of yours and whose son studied at your karate school, gave you some advice on acting. He told you not to verbalize what's already on the screen. Yeah. It almost seems like that became a code for you. I mean, you're really known in your movies as not saying a lot.
Most of your action actors, Stallone, Schwarzenegger, I think all of us kind of stick to that mode. Is that when there's something to say, say it. If it isn't important, then keep your mouth shut, and whether that's right or wrong is up to debate, but, the thing is that we're not Dustin Hoffman, who's got that ability to express in words, and because he can express in words and you can visualize them, but not many actors have that ability to verbally express himself, and you can, in your mind, see what he's saying, So the thing is, if you can show it on the screen visually rather than verbally, it's much better.
Chuck Norris is my guest, and in addition to starring in the new film Missing in Action, he's written an autobiography which is titled The Secret of Inner Strength. Let's talk about stunts some more. Now, do you always do your own stunts?
Not all of them. Some I don't do. If it's way out of my range of ability, then, of course, I won't do it. I don't do fire burns, which is really extremely dangerous.
That's what, like you're walking through an exploded bomb or something,
right,
like that?
Right, or catching on fire.
Uh-huh.
And things like that I wouldn't want to do. There's just certain things, or high dives. And I'm not a high diver, so I have to have a stunt double do that. But anything that requires balance or coordination or a certain amount of strength, then I can do that.
Well, I remember in Code of Silence, there's a great scene in which you're fighting with someone on top of a New York City train.
Right. Yeah, I did that.
And the train is moving. That's you. Mm-hmm. That wasn't a stuntman.
No, I did that.
Now the train was actually moving while you were doing that, wasn't it?
It was doing about 35 miles an hour. In fact, the thing is, the stuntman that I was fighting with was a little bit apprehensive about me doing that because we were relying on each other to keep our balance on that train because we're 50 feet in the air. That's an L train. We're 50 feet in the air. And he said, I don't know if you should do this or not. I said, well, look, let's do it with the train stopped. If you feel I'm not capable of doing it, then we'll bring in a stunt double. So we did it with the train stopped. And he said, no. He says, you'll do okay. So I did the fight with him.
Do you carry any kind of insurance?
Well, of course, the studio gets very upset when I do that because if I do get hurt, then production stops and it costs a lot of money. But the audience today, it's very sophisticated. They look to see if it's a stunt double or if it's the stunt man or it's the actor doing it. And so if it's something that I can do, then I like to do it. Especially when you do an acting scene, you really don't know if it's good or bad until it gets on the screen. But when you do a stunt, you know immediately whether it's good or bad. And there's an immediate exhilaration when you do a stunt that you don't get as in an acting scene.
Do you like the camera to go in for more close-ups than they usually would in an action scene to show that you really are doing the stunt?
Well, I like the camera to come close anyway, because the thing is, I talk mostly through my eyes. You know, I'm not a very expressionable person, except in my eyes. And if the camera doesn't zero in close, then I look like I have a blank stare on my face. But and that's very important, is that, you know, that the camera gets close enough to your eyes so that people can see what you're thinking.
I want to get back to this fight scene in Code of Silence on top of the train. How did you and the stuntman that you were working with keep your balance while the train was moving? What were some of the tricks to doing that?
Well, the tricks is just having the ability to maintain your balance up there. It's, you know, we had the fight prearranged, of course, but we're rolling all over the top of that train. And we're really controlling each other. You know, we're preventing each other from falling off. So we're really balancing each other as we're fighting on top of that train. And it just, you know, either you have the athletic ability to do it or you don't have it.
Now, as you're actually holding on to each other and trying to help each other keep balance, you have to look as if you're fighting each other and trying to throw each other off the top of the train.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you talk a little bit about how you kind of make it seem like you're trying to throw the person off the train while you're really hanging on to them?
Well, it's kind of a hard thing to describe, you know, because you're up there and you're just doing the thing as strong as you can without losing your balance. And a couple times, you know, I broke my balance once, but he controlled it for me, and then he broke his balance once, and I brought him back on balance. And it's just a matter of being able to have the experience and the ability to be able to do that.
Did you have signals to one another to alert one another if you felt like you were losing your balance or in serious
danger? No, because we could feel it. Mm-hmm. You can always tell when you get a hold of each other whether he's balanced or not, so we can always feel it in our body language.
Okay. Let's look at fight scenes for a second. When you're choreographing a fight scene where you'll be using martial arts, are there certain things that you think have to get into the scene, like a certain number of kicks or
no.
a certain amount of like really dazzling stuff?
No, the main thing, when I do a fight scene, I try to make it as real as possible. You know, the thing is that if I'm fighting two guys is one thing, if I'm fighting four, like in Code of Silence, I fought, 12 or 14, and I got the daylights beat out of me. You know, I didn't win because it would have been totally unrealistic for me to whip that whole bar room. And so in turn, you know, I wound up losing that fight. But that's the realism of it. If I'd have whipped everybody in that bar room, it would have been totally unrealistic. And no matter how good you are as a martial artist, you only have so much ability. And so in turn, I wound up losing that particular fight, but I tried to make it as exciting and as dramatic as I could before I got whipped.
You have a kind of spin kick that you do.
Yeah, spinning heel kick, yeah.
Would you describe that, what that is for listeners who haven't seen it?
It's like having a baseball bat in your hand and swinging it, you know, like a batter would swing at a ball. But you torque your whole body around in a full circle, and your leg swings around like a bat would. And it's extremely powerful kick. And I have to be, when I do that in my fight scenes, I got to be very, very careful, because if I hit one of my stuntmen with that, it would cause real serious damage.
Now, this is a kick you actually mastered in your other life as a karate
yeah,
master.
Right, uh-huh.
Do you try to get those into your fight scenes because they look so good?
Yeah, everybody loves those kicks. You know, they love for me to throw those kicks on screen, and I try to. But the thing is that I don't try to do a martial arts fight scene in a movie that doesn't really warrant it. If you try to, you know, squeeze a round hole in a square peg, it's a little tough, you know. And so the thing is, I try to make, when I do a movie, try to make it realistic and try to put the fight scenes in when it really is feasible to do it.
In your autobiography, you talk about having to break the pain barrier in karate, and you've had a lot of broken bones during your years as a karate teacher and as a karate student. You have broken hands, broken noses. So what do you mean when you say breaking the pain barrier?
Well, you're able to eliminate and really ignore the pain. It's something you practice and train, and you get to a point where you're able to really ignore the pain.
Is this something you've had to practice as a stuntman too? You know, in your role as doing your own stunts?
Oh yeah, that still doesn't mean I like pain, because I don't like pain. I'd prefer not to be hurt than being hurt. But the thing is, like in Firewalker, I broke my ankle in the second week in the filming, so I had to go 8 weeks with a broken ankle. and I couldn't put a cast on because I was still filming, so I had to keep it taped through the whole movie. So it was painful, but you learn to work with it.
Other times when a stunt has gone wrong, when someone who you were fighting with actually connected instead of almost connected, or when someone fell off something that they were...
Well, my poor brother has taken a tremendous beating. I've knocked him out twice. I broke his leg once, and so he's taken the worst beating of all the stuntmen I've worked with, because I work with him so much that sometimes we get carried away a lot of times, and I try to get too close to him, or he tries to get too close when I'm kicking at him, and so in turn we've made a little bit of contact, and he's had his injuries from our fights together.
How do you feel about actors who have a real tough guy image but don't do their own stunts?
Well, that's fine. You know, I see nothing wrong with that. It's probably the best thing to do is not do your own stunts because, first of all, you're taking pay away from a stuntman who, that's how he makes his living, is doing stunts. And so it's probably the best thing to do, and I probably shouldn't do it either, but it's right now it's kind of a thing I enjoy. I'm kind of a frustrated stuntman, I think.
Well, you kind of have to do it at this point, don't you, even if you didn't want to?
No, I don't think so. If I didn't want to, I wouldn't have to, no.
Okay, my guest is actor Chuck Norris, who is also a karate expert. He's starring in the new film Missing in Action Part 3, which he co-wrote. And he also just wrote an autobiography called The Secret of Inner Strength. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Chuck Norris is my guest. I recently saw your new movie, Missing in Action Part 3, Braddock.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's interesting. You're without a shirt during a good deal of the movie. And I wonder if that's intentional, to show off all the muscles.
No, not really, because I'm not an Arnold Schwarzenegger. But, in the torture scene that you saw, it was conducive to not have the shirt on. But
conducive to what?
Well, because I'm being electrocuted and all the stuff here, they have to be able to see the reaction of my body being electrocuted.
Can I tell you my reaction to that scene?
Sure.
Well, just to describe it, you're being tortured by South Vietnamese, right?
North Vietnamese.
North Vietnamese.
Well, he's a now he's from the Saigon, yeah.
Okay, and they've kidnapped your son. So you're being tortured in this cell. You're suspended by your hands. Your hands are tied over your head, and you're standing on your toes. Now your son is in bondage in a chair in front of you, and there's a gun pointed at him. And the torturer tells you that if you step down, you're on your toes, but
right.
if your heels touch the ground and your arms lower about an inch, that this gun is going to go off.
Shotgun, yes.
Yeah, and shoot your son.
Mm-hmm.
Now, seeing you kind of writhing up there with all your muscles exposed, it struck me as almost a sexual bondage scene.
Well, is that good or bad? I don't know.
I'm not trying to put any value on it. It just struck me, and I was wondering if that was conscious or not.
No, not with me. It wasn't conscious. No. I didn't see it as that.
How did you see it? But
maybe the women might. I don't know.
Or some men might. I don't know.
I don't know, really. Because I don't see myself as that way. So, but it's interesting you thought that way. But the thing is, what we were trying to show the mental torture as well, because here he is trying to force my feet down so the shotgun will go off and kill my son. So it was the tension in the mental torture that was going on as much as the physical torture, because it doesn't work out that way.
You're the woman who plays your long lost wife.
Yes.
In the movie, I hope I'm not giving too much away.
No,
is killed
no.
off pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And I think you're frequently in movies where you don't have a romantic interest
ladies.
In it. Yeah.
Yeah, my leading ladies don't last too long in my films, do they?
Well, why is that? Are you? Do you think it's part of your image to not get romantically involved?
No, not really. I think the key thing is creating an emotion that builds whoever plays the bad role to build up him being super bad, giving me a reason to retaliate for the atrocities that have been inflicted. And whoever it is that is in the movie with me, most of the time it's a woman.
A lot of adults in America, especially, you know, like parents of children, get very upset at certain action movies in which there's a lot of violence depicted. Now, I understand that you actually get more upset by movies that are sexually explicit.
Well, the thing is, when we talk about violence, again, it's how you do it. If you provoke violence on the screen, if it's a provocation of violence on the screen, then I don't think it's done in a very negative way. What I try, my films are kind of a retaliation against violence. And I don't see that as a bad thing for children to see. And I kind of have that reputation, I think, with the audiences, with the families throughout the country, that they don't mind their children coming to see my movies because it's action-oriented, but there's no extreme language, and there's no strong sexual scenes in the movie. And I think most families are more concerned about that than they are the action sequences in the movies.
Well, there's a scene in the movie, and this is part of the commercial that is being shown on television to advertise the movie. You're basically told by the CIA not to go into Vietnam and don't step on any toes there. Mm-hmm. And you say, I don't step on toes, I step on necks.
Yeah. Well, it was funny how that term came up. I was in New York about a year ago. And some kids are following me down the road, you know, and so they're all, you know, so they're talking to me and all this stuff here. And one kid says, man, he says, you don't step on toes, you step on necks, you know. And that's how I remember that. So that term kind of stuck in my mind. And so when the movie came about, I said, hey, I like that terminology. So that's why we inserted it into the movie.
But do you think stuff like that encourages violence in kids who go to see the movie?
No, because the thing is, what I'm basically saying is if you're walking down the street and you're attacked by a robber or a rapist or whatever, you know, you've got to do whatever you can to get out of that situation. And you can't be stepping on the guy's toes. You're going to be stepping on something harder than that. And that's what I'm trying to say is if someone pushes me, I'm going to push back twice as hard. And that's what when he says, don't step on toes, I'm saying, I don't step on toes. You know, if you step on my toe, I'm going to step on your neck.
Now, for some of your movies, or at least one of them, I know you went to argue with the rating board that the film deserved a PG instead of an R rating. Mm-hmm. Which movie was it?
Oh, Good Guy. Well, three of my movies.
Three of the movies.
Yeah, Good Guys Wear Black, Lone Wolf McQuade, and one other film. But the thing is, it doesn't seem to matter in my films whether they're R or PG. I think, you know, people, you know.
Everybody goes.
They still go.
What argument did you use, though?
Well, I think the thing is, basically what I was explaining to you is that it's how action is demonstrated on the screen. If it's a malicious type violence where you're provoking it and it's not good. But the thing is, with me, my films being a man who was faced with something that he must deal with, like John Wayne did in the 50s and 60s. It's basically a modernization of the old John Wayne movies, if you really analyze them. Then I don't think it's bad for children to see them. And in the three times I've debated it, I've won all three times. But I got tired of debating every time my movie came out. And it seemed like it didn't matter whether my movie was a PG or an R. It seemed like the same audience came anyway, so I just got tired of debating it.
Chuck Norris is my guest. He's an actor and star of the new movie Missing in Action Part 3. He's also written an autobiography called The Secret of Inner Strength. You're approaching 50 now, right?
Well, I'm a little ways off yet, but
okay.
But I'm on the top end of it, yeah.
Okay. Are there roles that... do you have a different sense now of the kind of role you want to get in the future, of the direction you want to head in?
No. Well, the main thing is condition-wise. I'm in better shape now than I was 20 years ago when I was a fighter. I'm stronger and I'm faster now than I was when I was in my 30s. And so the thing is, physically, I can do anything that I want to do. But whether I want to veer out and do other things, you know, something I've got to think about. If the audiences start getting tired of the type of movies I'm doing, then I've got to reconsider what it is I want to do. And I'm not really sure yet.
In your movies, your character is constantly being provoked to use his martial arts skills and to pull out guns and knives as well. Do people ever try to take you out in real life? Have you been called on in real life to use those skills?
I've never had to use it. I've been all over the world and traveled everywhere, and I've never had anyone approach me in that respect. I think mainly, again, it's the philosophy that I demonstrate on the screen. It's not a guy who's walking around looking for trouble with a chip on his shoulder. That's what brings that type of people on to challenge you. It's a guy who doesn't want trouble, but he's forced into the situation to have to deal with it. And with that philosophy in mind, it's not the type of character that people think that you're walking around looking for trouble. And so in turn, I don't think, that's probably one of the reasons I haven't been encountered that way.
I'm sure that knowing the martial arts gives you a lot of self-confidence. Have you ever used that to psych someone out in a potentially violent situation?
Not in an antagonizing way. Again, when you see trouble happening, you try to diffuse it before it becomes uncontrollable. And I've had to do that several times where I've been able to diffuse a potential physical altercation before it got to that extreme. And that's part of, and the thing is, if you don't get emotionally involved and you analyze the situation of why it's happening, generally you can get out of it. And when, especially when the person realizes you're not doing it because you're afraid, but you're doing it just because you don't want the trouble. And they can feel that. They can generally get a sense of that. And when they do, then if you give them an out, then generally they will take it.
Do you ever go to movie theaters to watch your adventure films with audiences to see how they react?
All the time. All the time, yeah. Because that's how you get a bead on whether the people like your film or what they do and don't like. And so I like to do that a lot, is sit in the audience and see if they're responding to the scenes the way I hope they will respond. And if they don't, then I say, uh-oh, well, then I've got to figure out what's wrong here. So, but yeah, I do that a lot.
What's your favorite kind of audience to watch with?
Well, of course, an audience that really gets emotionally involved in the film, because I try to create that emotion. And, the attempted rape scene in the movie, with the girl. I go to the extremes of dealing with that person, but the thing is that the audience really, here's this guy who's trying to rape this, young teenage girl, and I stop it and I take care of him, and the audience really gets a kick out of that,
Okay. What effect do you think you've had on the American view of maleness?
God, Jesus, I don't know. I don't know if I've had any effect on that respect. Because again, I don't even think of me having a maleness type of an effect on the audience. I just play a particular type of character that I enjoy being. It was a character that I demonstrated as a karate instructor for 15 years, and I've tried to carry it on into my screen life. And a guy who's has a certain compassion for life and people, and doesn't want violence, but then he's put into a position that there's no choice but to deal with it. And we all would have to do that in our life if we're forced into it.
Well, Chuck Norris, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being with us.
You bet. My pleasure.
My guest has been action star Chuck Norris. He stars in the new movie Braddock, Missing in Action, Part 3. He's also the author of a new autobiography titled The Secret of Inner Strength, published by Little Brown. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Jonathan Kozel. For many years, he taught in an elementary school in a poor black neighborhood in Boston. He's written books on inner-city education, including Death at an Early Age. His new book, Rachel and Her Children, is about the time he spent at a shelter for the homeless in New York City. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with Penn Jillette, one half of the comedy and magic team of Penn and Teller. Their off-the-wall, sometimes sadistic magic show is now playing on Broadway. Also, rock historian Ed Ward plays some records that were banned from the radio in the 1950s because they were considered too risque. And book critic John Leonard reviews Woodcutters by Austrian novelist Thomas Bernhard. It's a bleak look at the lives of marginal artists in Vienna. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. President Reagan today explained to Republican congressional leaders the contra-aid package which he will send to Congress tomorrow. The president is asking for $36.25 million, with about 10% to be used for arms and ammunition. House Minority Leader Robert Michael says the lethal aid would be held in escrow until the end of March. It would be released if the administration does not certify that a ceasefire is in place. Michael says he thinks the aid request will pass.
I'm counting on it. Certainly you don't go into any fight thinking you're going to lose, but it's not going to be an overwhelming win, because we've always had to scratch for it, because there are those, unfortunately, too large a number in the House who position themselves on the other side of it in concrete that can't be moved. But there's a swing vote out there that can be had, and I think when the arguments are made, they'll be persuaded to go along with us.
Michael says the aid package would cover the Contras for about 4 months. CBS anchor Dan Rather said today that he wants people to understand that he respects the office of the vice presidency. His comment follows an emotional exchange yesterday on the CBS Evening News between Rather and Vice President George Bush, who is also a Republican presidential candidate. CBS affiliates around the country say they were overwhelmed with phone calls in support of Bush following the argument, which began as an interview on Bush's involvement in the Iran-Contra scandal. Today, Rather defended his handling of the interview, saying, quote, "There are situations that happen every campaign trail in which there are spirited answers and some spirited questions." On the heels of the Howard Beach trial, New York Governor Mario Cuomo has appointed a special prosecutor to investigate another alleged racial assault, this time in upstate New York. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
Governor Cuomo's appointment today was his second naming of a special prosecutor to investigate a racial attack. A year ago, Cuomo brought in a special prosecutor for the Howard Beach case, and that trial ended in December with 3 convictions for manslaughter and assault. The case Cuomo addressed today took place in late November in Wappinger Falls, New York. A 16-year-old black girl who had been kidnapped was found alive, wrapped in a garbage bag. The words KKK and nigger were written on her body, and she was smeared with feces. The girl said her abductors were white and one had displayed a police-like badge. Because of this, the girl refused to cooperate with police. The case drew the attention of the local NAACP chapter and other black groups. The county district attorney withdrew because of a conflict of interest. Today, Governor Cuomo appointed Robert Abrams, the state attorney general, to take over the case. I'm Mike Schuster in New York.
Leading U.S. arms negotiators today tried to answer conservative critics of the Intermediate-Range Missile Treaty, who say the pact does not contain enough safeguards against Soviet cheating. Republican Senator Jesse Helms called the treaty fatally flawed because he says it does not require the Soviets to destroy the warheads on their medium-range missiles. But the man who led the team which negotiated the treaty, Maynard Glitman, says the pact calls for making the warheads inoperable. Only the fissionable material will be saved. The West German government admitted today it turned down a U.S. extradition request for a suspected hijacker out of concern for the lives of 2 West German hostages in Lebanon. The admission came from a top government official during a terrorist trial in Dusseldorf. Deidre Berger reports.
Abbas Hamadi is on trial for arranging to kidnap 2 West Germans in Beirut and for intimidating the West German government. The kidnappers of the 2 hostages repeatedly threatened to kill or harm the men if Bonn delivered Hamadi's brother Mohammed to the U.S., where he is wanted for helping to hijack a TWA jet to Beirut in 1985. Today, Wolfgang Schäuble, a top aide to Chancellor Helmut Kohl, said the kidnapper's threats played a major role in Bonn's decision not to extradite the alleged hijacker to the U.S.
Deidre Berger in Cologne. Stock prices fell on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 26 points to close at 1920.42. I'm Mara Liasson in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of the early career of singer Hank Ballard. Back in the late 50s, Ballard recorded The Twist, before Chubby Checker did. But in the early 50s, still in his teens, Ballard was recording songs that raised eyebrows and rock and roll sales.
According to conventional wisdom, rock and roll was born when white middle-class kids started to buy rhythm and blues records made by then-popular black artists. If that's so, then Hank Ballard must be the father of rock and roll and Annie its mother. Nobody's quite sure who Annie may have been, but we do know about Hank Ballard. He was born in Detroit in 1936 and had his first hit at the ripe old age of 16 with the classic Every Beat of My Heart, a typical subdued ballad in the mold of the Orioles. Like the next few records he sang on, it was released under the name of his group, The Royals, which quickly became a problem. He was on the same label as another, better known and more popular group, the Five Royales, and Ballard's unscrupulous manager had been known to put up posters, inferring that the Five Royales were going to play dates for which the Royals were booked. After a lawsuit, this got straightened out, and the new name became Hank Ballard and the Midnighters. To celebrate the change, they recorded one of the most notorious songs of all time. With Me Annie was pretty strong stuff for 1954, whereas some of the blues singers of the previous generation had cloaked their sexual come-ons in colorful metaphors, Ballard's plea to give me all my meat was pretty upfront. This had two immediate results. The record was completely banned from the radio, and it wound up selling well over a million copies, a sizable number of them to white kids. Ballard must have anticipated this, because just a few months later, he came out with this.
Annie had a baby.
But did Annie Had a Baby mean that Hank Ballard had turned into a sexually responsible citizen? Hardly. For one thing, there's no song about him actually marrying Annie. And for another, he completed the famous Annie trilogy of 1954 with this. Maybe or no, it was only Annie's Aunt Fanny that kept Hank from working with poor Annie yet again. Not only were all three of these records banned, But so was this, which was the actual follow-up to Work With Me, Annie. Sexy Ways, like the Annie trilogy, was just too strong for the times. The net result was that Hank Ballard and the Midnighters' career was put on hold for 5 years before they had another hit. But if there's anything teenagers like, it's what's forbidden. And for many mid-50s teens, these were the first black records they'd ever bought. Once you get over the crudeness and hear Ballard's expressive voice and Billy Davis's hot guitar, you might decide this was something you liked and go find more. After all, there were plenty of vocal groups around, and this was their golden age. Still, the legacy of the Annie records shouldn't be discounted. They were the password to the first musical secret society of American teenagers, and among the first underground classics. And 2 years after they were released, far from any black people in Lubbock, Texas, young Buddy Holly recorded his own tribute to Annie.
Well, if you see old Annie, better give her a lift. 'Cause Annie's been a-working on a midnight shift. If Annie puts a hair up on her head, paints him lips a bright, bright red, wears that dress that fits real tight, starts staying out till the middle of the night, says that a friend give her a lift. Well, Annie's been a-working on a midnight shift. If she acts a little funny, seems a little...
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. Hank Ballard is currently touring with former Midnighter Billy Davis. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Penn Jillette of the magic and comedy team of Penn and Teller. Teller is the short, silent magician. Penn is the tall, husky juggler and card shark who also provides the narration, jokes, and verbal abuse. Audiences usually expect a team like this to swallow swords, eat fire, and pull rabbits out of hats. Penn and Teller can do that, but they almost always add a surprising twist, as David Letterman once found out when they appeared on his late-night TV show. Letterman asked the duo to really surprise him. And they did. After a familiar set of magic tricks, they set a black top hat on Letterman's desk. No surprise, until they lifted the hat, releasing several hundred live cockroaches. Penn and Teller are currently performing on Broadway. They've also made specials for PBS and Showtime Cable Network, and Penn co-wrote Ron Reagan's current Cinemax special. Penn describes the act he performs with Teller as being for people who hate magic. I asked him what kind of magic he hated.
When people picture magic, they picture that kind of old guy in a tux pushing women in bad bikinis into boxes while playing, you know, Star Wars music or something. And there's a whole lot of people that would like what we do that wouldn't like the standard magic things. Was just the most important thing was to get that image of pushing women around out of people's minds so that we could do what we do.
Your specialty is juggling, and I wonder what first interested you in that.
Well, when you're about 12 or 13 years old and not involved in sports at all, it was a very good way to feel special. And so I just practiced a lot in high school. And actually, all the juggling skills that I have, I don't think I've gotten any better since I was 18, which I say with a little bit of pride. It means I've had other things to do since then.
You describe some of the cliches in magic that you really grew to hate. What were some of the cliches in juggling that you wanted to avoid as a juggler?
Well, the cliches in juggling actually came in later. There's a whole feeling now where juggling is being tied in with what's called new vaudeville, which is something that I'm not very fond of. It has a real hippie connotation to it. And we aren't the kind of guys that live in buses. So we were kind of phasing out a little bit of the juggling, because there is such that feeling that we're trying to bring back some sort of golden age that never existed. People like the Karamazovs and Avner really have a good solid love of what they consider to be vaudeville, and Teller and I have either ignorance or a slight distaste for that same period.
How come?
It just seems like there's a feeling of putting old wine in new bottles. It's kind of like, well, we'll do the same stuff and it'll be quaint. And if there's one thing that Teller and I don't want to be, it's quaint.
You studied at Barnum and Bailey Clown College, as I recall.
Yow.
What kind of life is that supposed to prepare you for?
I have no idea. They're kind of running clowns through this whole thing, so they can just turn out essentially people who will dress up and walk around in parades. I went to Ringling Brothers when I was 18, 13, 14 years ago, and at that time it was very good for me, because I just got a lot of the skills that I didn't have before. I got a little bit of fire reading down and stuff like that. But as far as their actual theories on comedy, they are working places like Madison Square Garden, and I think there's a little bit of an emphasis on lowest common denominator, which is what I wasn't that interested in there.
Did you ever consider joining a circus or a carnival?
Well, when I went to Ringling Brothers, I was very, very interested in joining the circus, and by the time I got done with their training program, that interest kind of faded away. Because there's so little time in a three-hour show with hundreds of people in it, to just get an idea and put it across is very, very difficult. So working with a smaller group, all I have to fight with is Teller and not a corporation.
In your shows, you sometimes make it seem like magic and juggling are a lot of showmanship. And then after you've told the audience that, then you really make it come alive and make it seem truly magical.
Well, I really believe that there's a philosophy in magic that is in really all of magic. There's a level of condescension, the I can do something that you can't. And the problem with that theory is that when you're doing the show, you have people in your audience that can do heart surgery and fix motorcycles. I mean, program computers. And I think that in no other form of performance do people come out and have that kind of chip on their shoulder. So we take for granted that every single person in our audience, when they were 12 or 13 years old, read one magic book and learned one magic trick, and take that as a given. And I don't like that kind of Doug Henning coming out and saying, oh, just suspend all your disbelief and be children for a while. We don't want children in our audience. We want people to come with a real chip on their shoulder and knowing that what we're doing is swindling, because that's where the real fun of it is.
I'm sure a lot of magicians don't like you calling magic swindling and tricks. Do you get some negative reactions from some of the older magicians?
We try so hard to be bad boys, and we try so hard to make people like Harry Blackstone Jr. and Henning and Copperfield angry at us. But unfortunately, they're such professionals, and they're so good at what they do. I think they understand completely what it is we're trying to do. The only problems we've had, and we have had problems, has been with amateurs. Because they read the books and they take rules that are simply learning tools and act like they were moral rules.
Magicians and jugglers frequently wear capes and hats, and there's this whole costuming for that profession. And you guys started off performing, well, you would wear T-shirts and jeans, as I remember, mm-hmm. and Teller used to wear tights.
Yeah.
And now you both wear three-piece suits, which I can't think of anybody else who's ever worn three-piece suits in a magic kind of show. Well, how did you get the idea to dress that way?
There's a fascinating piece of history that ties in with this. When you picture the standard magician, you picture top hat and tails. Now, the reason you picture that is in the late 19th century, when magic was really flourishing. In Europe, a magician got the brilliant idea that what he was going to do was to dress just like his audience, which at that time was top hat and tails. And then years went by, and all the technology of magic was built around how you can hide a bird inside the tails of a tailcoat. And magicians held on to that, and the basic idea behind it was completely lost. Teller and I decided that it would put more emphasis on us and what we were doing. And after all, the show is Penn and Teller, and it is unabashedly about us, if we took away anything people could hold on to. So we're wearing the clothes that are the closest, if not to our audience, then the closest to invisible. It makes people have to deal with us. They can't say, oh, that guy's wearing a sweater. That's the kind of guy he is. You know, he's wearing this kind of clothes. He's a Robin Williams kind of guy. He's wearing a leather jacket. He's a Bruce Springsteen kind of guy. You can't do that at all with a suit coat. And also the fact that I think that with our difference in sizes, the fact that we're dressed identical always makes me smile. It's kind of a monkey's thing happening there, you know.
In a cable special that you and Teller did, you ran your own magic store. That's how the story started. And I wonder if you still hang out in magic stores a lot, if that's still as much fun as it used to be.
We do go occasionally. I never hung out that much. Teller did very, very much in his youth. And what we had felt every time that a magic store was portrayed on television or in movies, it was always portrayed as a very mystical, wonderful Tinkerbell-type place. And the angle we wanted to give to it, which I think is the wonderful angle, is essentially a magic store is some old guy ripping off children. And the magic store had never been, I had never seen one in a movie or television that was dirty. Invisible Thread is a little bit of a love letter to the cheesy, sleazy guys that really run those magic stores. And the nice thing was the magic store that Teller hung out in, which was the a magic store in New York that he hung out with when he was a kid, the man who owned it came to see Invisible Thread. Teller invited him to the screening, and afterwards he said, you know, that's just what I do. You guys really nailed it, you know? That Copperfield does this trick. I use that line all the time. It was just wonderful that he recognized what we were really trying to do. And so I think that I've unfortunately outgrown it a little bit, and also I can't go into a magic store and be taken anymore, and that's what I liked most about it. So I guess the answer is, in actuality, I don't really visit magic stores, but in my head, I do an awful lot. I have wonderful fond memories of that cheesiness.
Penn Jillette of the magic and comedy team of Penn and Teller. They're performing on Broadway until March 20th, and they have a new home video called Penn and Teller Cruel Tricks for Dear Friends, due out in March. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, we're following some of the fallout from last night's State of the Union address, for one thing, how the Congress has reacted to President Reagan's pledge that he will not sign another huge continuing resolution, big spending bill of the sort that he signed at the end of last year, and that he also intends to rescind some of the measures that were inside that bill. We also found a familiar passage in the State of the Union, and we'll be tracing it back to its sources. That also reports of what the administration's aid request for the Nicaraguan Contras is going to be, and more on the George and Dan show, Vice President Bush's interview by Dan Rather last night on CBS.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Woodcutters by Austrian writer Thomas Bernhardt. Bernhardt grew up in Salzburg and Vienna and studied music before becoming a writer. He's won several literary and poetry prizes in Germany. Woodcutters was first published there in 1984. The novel is set in a bleak corner of the Viennese art world.
It would be a big mistake to think that Thomas Bernhardt is making fun of the artists and intellectuals in his novels for whom consciousness itself is a disease, and contempt and despair the only permissible emotions, and insanity or death the only cure. These monomaniacs feel bad because bad is the only way to feel. It's clear by now from books like Gargoyles, Concrete, and Gathering Evidence that the Austrian novelist and playwright feels just as bad as his characters, who hate the provinces and Vienna, the family and society, democracy and sex. Bernhardt's often compared to Kafka and Beckett, but compared to Bernhardt, Kafka is Mary Poppins, and Beckett is Chuckles the Clown on the old Mary Tyler Moore TV show. Like Concrete, Bernhardt's new novel, Woodcutters, is all one paragraph. We are trapped in the mind of a Viennese novelist, as in Concrete we were trapped in the mind of a Viennese music critic. This nameless novelist goes to a very late dinner party of potato soup and boiled pike at the apartment of friends he has avoided for more than 20 years. The occasion is to honor an actor who's a smashing success in a new production of Ibsen's The Wild Duck. In fact, most of the guests have just come from the funeral of an old acquaintance, a ballerina who hanged herself, about whom they all feel guilty or ought to. Like the self-lacerating novelist and the tiresomely talkative actor and the dead dancer, everyone in the novel is in some way an artistic also-ran, a composer of Webern-like fragments, a painter of chic tapestries, a singer of disconsolate leader, a Viennese Gertrude Stein, and a Viennese Virginia Woolf, and so on. They were young and geniuses together in the 1950s. They are this evening middle-aged, compromised, corrupt, and hateful. They will end up screaming their guilt and disappointment at one another. The novelist sits in a wing chair in the dark, looking into a music room lit like a stage. The others are fixed, as if in aspic, the discharge of his interior harangue. He savages their social hypocrisy, their artistic pretension, their parasitic emotional lives, their moral negligence, and their eating habits. He also savages his own. In the end, he says, there was always much less left of me than there was of them. I hated Vienna, yet found it somehow touching. I cursed these people, yet could not help loving them. It seems to be nobody's fault that they are all inadequate and unhappy. We are born to die, and the rest is babbling in the dark. The reader emerging from this claustrophobic incantation won't love anybody. No wonder the ballerina hanged herself. But there's also a terrible obsessive power to woodcutters, a merciless piling on of details so exact they burn, of noticings so scalpel-sharp they sever our connection to any easy piety or lazy comfort or mercy or forgiveness. This is a wounded mind like the century it lives in, at the end of its tether. There a Beckett barks and a Bernhardt bites.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Woodcutters by Thomas Bernhardt. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with songwriter, performer, and record producer T-Bone Burnett. As a producer, he's worked with Roy Orbison, Elvis Costello, and Los Lobos. His latest client is himself. His new album is titled The Talking Animals. Also, language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will talk about the bomb. The new warfare has new warriors who speak a new language. The MX is now a damage limitation weapon. And classical music critic Lord Schwartz will review a performance by Cho Lang Lin of the Mozart Violin Concertos No. 3 and 5. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.